Well, it's my pleasure today to introduce to you on the Solari Report an extraordinary scholar. We have been searching for several years for someone who can approach the topic of water and the geopolitics of water from the perspective of a real scholar who understands history and but also understands what's happening currently. And so we're very pleased to introduce Dr. Tarai Tevet, who is a professor at the Department of Geography at the University of Bergen and a professor in global history at the University of Oslo, both in Norway. And he has kindly consented to do this interview. He's in, I believe he's in the UK, probably, I think at Oxford. You're at Oxford?
Cambridge at the moment.
Cambridge. And to join us today for a topic for our discussion about the importance of water and the geopolitics of water. And so, Dr. Tevet, it's a real privilege to have you join us on the Solari Report. And I wanted to start off today by asking you about how you became arguably the leading scholar globally in the history of water and the geopolitics of water. How did this become your passion?
Well, I don't know about the description, but, well, I had been interested in water for quite a long time, but then, but just in a normal way, I suppose. But then it was during the early 1980s, I moved from Oslo, which is a quite dry part of Norway, to what I call the Scandinavian rain coast, that is Bergen, on the west coast of Norway. And then suddenly, you know, I had an old car with a hole in the floor. So each time it was raining, I get wet on my feet. I had to put on rubber boots every time it was raining.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly, you know, this was in November, I looked down on my feet and then I said, I've had these rubber boots or these boots on me every day now. So it had been raining all day, every day, day in and day out, for quite a few months, and suddenly I guess that this is very, very interesting from a social point of view, and I ran down to my fellow students and I started talking about it, you know, but nobody was interested.
Uh-huh.
It had already become normal. It was, well, it's Bergen. Well, what are you talking about? Yeah, I mean, it's not interesting at all. So this, this water blindness, I would say, that I discovered there among my fellow students because they had been used to the impact that the rain had on my lives. But to me, it was new. It was brand new. So I had to, you know, start asking all these questions. How will the way the rain is falling impact in society's economies, the way people live, what the children do after school, what kind of games they are playing, all these kind of things.
Uh-huh.
Is of course impacted by the water landscape.
You know, it's I love your expression. Did I hear this right? I love your expression, water blindness.
Yeah. And I got a water shock.
Because, you know,
from the east of Norway to the west coast of Norway. I suddenly realized, and at the same time, I had just started to study Middle Eastern history. So I had been down to Egypt a couple of times, and, you know, the rain might be 18 millimeters a year, or in Aswan, you might have 3 years without a raindrop, while in Bergen it rains on average 2,000 millimeters a year.
Uh-huh.
So this difference provides a kind of a key for comparing societies over time and in space, of course. So that was for me the beginning. I mean, I just realized that this question of how the water is running in the landscape
has
a lot of implications.
Before we go back through history, let me just ask you, there's great debate, you know, if you're a lay person today, on whether or not the world is in a global water crisis. And I would love to know, do we have a global crisis, and why is it that water has become so important, and, if you will, we're coming out of what you call our water blindness?
Well, I don't know whether we have a global water crisis. We might have a regional and local water crisis, but according to my opinion, not a global one. Of course, during the last century, a lot of things happened that made the gap between supply of water and the demand of water, that gap grew, partly because of the spread of irrigation. Of course, during the last century, the area under irrigation doubled from 1900 to 1940, and then again from 1940 to 1990. The demand for water grew fantastically, of course. And then you also have the globalization, you might say, industrialization, which also requires water to a large extent. And you have the urbanization problems. We have three revolutions, I would say, that all put greater pressure upon the water resources. And in addition, you had the growth of population, of course, from 1 billion around the start of the century and 6 billion, around 6 billion at the end of it. So all this created a bigger, concern for water all over the place. But it was not a crisis in all parts of the world, far from it. I also think that in this discussion it has been somewhat overlooked the ability societies have to adapt to new water situations, and also the fact that they all the time discover new water sources. After all, 99% of the water, the fresh water of the world, is under our feet, right?
Right.
So, some years back, they discovered this fantastic Guarani aquifer in South America, bigger than Spain and France together. And now they have found enormous amount of water under the desert of Somalia. So there are water there in many places. But in some areas, of course, like in part of the Nile Valley, in the Gulf area, in part of Asia, and in part of South America, and in part of western part of the United States, you have a water crisis, of course.
We, in the United States, we've had in the last decade significant, more serious droughts here, and it has focused many people on water in a way that we haven't been focused before. So it's very much coming into our consciousness now. And I wanted to just mention, I had put links on our blog post to your two documentaries, The Future of Water and The History of Water. And I think they're both excellent, excellent documentaries to understand sort of how we got to where we are and what the issues are before us. If you could just describe those two documentaries, I think that would be helpful.
Well, they are the aim has been to try to describe how all societies, the history of all societies, is written in water, in a way. From the first agricultural civilization, from Jericho, the first city in the world, in the desert there in Palestine today, to Las Vegas or New York or whatever. All cities, all countries, wherever you go, have been forced to relate to fresh water in one way or another. So the history of water documentary is trying to depict the variety or the different ways people in Pakistan, in China, in Britain, in the United States, in Bakersfield, California, and the event, in Norway, all over the place, are relating to this water and how that is impacting the society and how people are changing themselves and society by trying to control water. The future of water is more related to the whole question of global climatic change and what will happen. If the climate is changing, of course, that will first and foremost manifest itself in changes in the way water is running in landscape. Either more droughts, less drought, more floods, more rain, less rain. So if the climate is changing, and to the extent the climate is changing, the issue of water will become much, much more important even than it is today. So that is trying to how the different areas of the world will have to cope. I mean, China, India, Venice, for example, today are fighting, as most of us know, a desperate struggle, of course, to keep the ocean out. Well, to the Maya civilization, we are moving around the globe.
Right. One of the things that really struck me, I read your book, one of the volumes of the History of Water, and the one called Water Geopolitics and the New World Order. And what I hadn't been thinking of is, you know, we each think of water as different things, but water is not just drinking water, and it's not just the water that is necessary to grow our food. It's also transportation. It's also energy. You know, it's also used in warfare. It can also, you know, if there's a flood, it can surprise. Water is so, you know, it's so ubiquitous to all the different aspects of our life. And we have this water blindness, and we don't realize all the different ways a shift in the water, whether it's the water table or a shift in the river, can just change, you know, trigger changes throughout the entire you know, environmental and financial ecosystem. It's quite extraordinary. And I think, to me, going back in history really helps to understand, you know, sort of water and water control. Now, you, in your books, you go back through many different societies, but I thought we could come into the modern period and talk. One of the areas I wanted to talk about today was China and India. You know, day-to-day I'm an investment advisor, and one of the things we're told is that India and China will have fantastic economic growth rates, but all of that depends on water, and I think both societies face enormous water challenges, and maybe you could describe a little bit about China and India and what their water situation is.
Of course, I agree with you. The water issue is of tremendous importance for both of those countries. And that is also comes also clear in their plans. I mean, at the moment, while we are speaking, China is implementing the biggest industrial project in history. They are moving 5% of the water of the Yangtze via canals all the way up to Beijing and 1,800 kilometers to the north, in order to save the North China Plain, because there the groundwater has been sinking, and also in order to save the Yellow River, because the Yellow River is not bringing water into the ocean anymore in many years.
Really?
And to save all the cities that are suffering water shortages along and on the China, North China Plain. And a tremendous budget. And in India, they are talking about and discussing what they call a national water plan that is supposed to link all the 37 rivers coming from Himalaya in one man-control system. And again, linking that system to all the rivers on the southern parts of the Indian continent. So they talk about destroying the power of the monsoon, because the power of the monsoon is whether it's a good monsoon or a bad monsoon, it affects to that extent. So both of these countries have big profits. But then, of course, China is controlling most of the rivers, because a big river is coming to India.
Do you think these projects will be successful in achieving their purpose?
I mean, the Chinese one has already come quite far. I mean, the first canal reached Beijing before the Olympic Games in 2008.
Right.
You know, before the Chinese had discussed that they have to move the capital to water or move water to the capital. They decided to move water to the capital. And this project should help them with that. But then, I mean, what would happen with the bases in Himalaya? What would happen if the Chinese, now, as we again speak, the Chinese are building a dam on the Tibetan plateau, the highest dam in the world when it comes to miniature adult sea level, they are using some space technology developed in China because it's so high. What will happen to dramatically to the river feeding natural agriculture in India and Bangladesh if the Chinese are building all these types?
You know, one of the things I wondered was whether one of the reasons the Chinese, when I was reading your book on the New World Order, was whether the Chinese went into Tibet in part because of the water resources and the water question.
Well, whether they went in, I mean, they thought that they had the historical right to Tibet, I suppose. But what is true, what is the case, according to my opinion, is that for China, it would be better way. I mean, to give away Tibet would be a last resort because Tibet is a water tower, not only of India, but also of China.
Right.
So for China to control Tibet is a question of life or death, I suppose, when it comes to the water resources they need, and which they always have needed, because China is, of course, a society that through the ages has been built around control of the rivers, in one way or another.
So the other area that you talk a lot about is the Middle East and Turkey and Syria. And maybe we could touch about on water in the Middle East and how that has been impacting the events in the Middle East over the last few decades.
Yes, Turkey, non-Arab country, has control over the waters to the Arab countries in Syria and Iraq. So the Arab countries are positioned in a very relatively weak position when it comes to the water here also, as they are in the Nile Basin. Turkey is developing that part of the Euphrates Basin where the Kurds are living in Turkey. So the whole water management strategy has from the very beginning been closely linked to regional geopolitics. After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, Iraq became pretty much weakened. And after that, Turkey has had no real opposition in the basin. So they have been able to do more than this, and they have wanted to do. There are different opinions about how affected Syria and Iraq have been of their projects, but definitely, Turkey has now become the broader power in the basin, something that they were not before in 1990. The shift in power is dramatic if you see it in a long historical perspective.
The one of your books that I have gotten, but I haven't had a chance to finish yet, is your book on the Nile. And, of course, if you're interested in water, the Nile has got to be, you know, I don't know if there is such a thing as the most fascinating river. You think it is? Well,
take the prize there, yeah.
Okay, well, tell us about the Nile and the, you know, the power of the Nile in terms of the history of sort of water management, water channeling.
Well, you know, Egypt has been the river's country, the river state, you might say, per se, for thousands of years. Already Herodot, I mean, the Greek writer of history, said that everybody should envy the Egyptians because it was so easy to cultivate there because of the yearly Nile flood. So Egypt has became the granary of the Roman Empire, the cotton farm of the British Empire, although there was no rain there, everything because of the Nile. So they have been dependent on the Nile all the time and have gradually come to regard the Nile as their river. In the last century, the Sudan started to use the river, so also they have become a modern Adriatic state, you might say, where the interest has been directed more and more towards Nile control, especially after the Southern Sudan left in 2011, because Southern Sudan was the water-rich part of that country. But what is happening now is, of course, also a fiscal long-term historical implications. I mean, the upstream states, Ethiopia, especially Ethiopia, they're 90%, about 90% of the water of Nile comes from Ethiopia, and Uganda, and Kenya, and Tanzania. All these countries, they say, we want to use Nile as well. The river is coming from other countries. We have a right to use it. While Egypt and Sudan say, no, according to international agreement, formulated and entered into during the British period, they are not entitled to waters unless Egypt accepts it. So it's a quite interesting situation that at the center of the political struggle in the Nile Basin today is old water diplomatic agreements made during the British period. Egypt and Sudan, especially Egypt, try to maintain them, while the other countries say we should do away with them. So, and the solution to that conflict will, of course, have tremendous implications for how much water Egypt will have in the future.
Well, you can really see.
For 5,000 years, this river has been the River Egypt.
Yeah.
Now, during a few years, 5 years, this is about to change. It's a dramatic shift if you look upon this in a long-term perspective.
Right. Well, all the governance and investment patterns have been around, you know, one set of variables, and suddenly, as the water grows more important, it's almost as though it creates a seizure politically, and it reinvents how the governance and investment relationships have to work. And of course, it's, you know, it's something that's terribly important to people. And you can see the, you know, the way this deep, important thing changes everything. I wanted to bring up one other example from history.
May I just add one?
Oh, yes, please.
About the things you mentioned. I mean, you have had in the UK here, as some other places in Africa. I mean, the Chinese has come in. The World Bank, you know, they had a policy that they would not give loans to any country in the Nile Basin without all the countries be in agreement about the project that they would go and give loan to. That is a long-standing World Bank policy. This has meant that Egypt could say, no, we don't like that project, so, and if they don't like it, it has been very difficult for the World Bank to give loan. The Chinese do not have the same strings attached to their policy. So they come in, and it suddenly then becomes possible for these countries to get money to finance the profits that they need in order to control the Nile in their country.
Yeah, many of the rules are going to be instituted through the credit system because, for example, I just got a call from one of my subscribers this morning, and who informed me that when a property is foreclosed by the, you know, many of the properties in the United States, the mortgages are financed by government insurance, and so now when any property that is financed with government insurance is foreclosed by the government, they are planning on automatically reselling without the mineral rights, which gives them control of the water even after they resell. And what he said, and I have to confirm this, was that the, you know, essentially they could only resell the mineral rights with an expressed permission of the government. And, you know, so what you're seeing is a takeover literally of the water rights as this process of foreclosure happens is what he's claiming. And so...
Yeah. That's very interesting. Something what we have discovered. I mean, I'm presently editing a book on the water law and the history of water and the different traditions when it comes to water law from country to country. Is that quite striking? I mean, in Norway, the water has always been private in a way. In other countries, the water is owned by the state or it's God-given or whatever. And in the United States, you have a bit different again. So, I mean, how the law of the of water has different from country to country, I think, is a very telling story of how the relationship between nature and society differs from country to country.
Well, if water, as water becomes more important, then our interdependence requires more cooperation, and then our, you know, the planning of many of these projects and the investment requires more resources, which in turn affirms the interdependence. So it's going to require, you know, much greater levels of cooperation with far more money and risk than we're used to as a society. And I think that's one of the reasons that what the Chinese are doing is so interesting, because they've been able to amass such a strategic long-term project with major investment. It's quite extraordinary in terms of their, you know, willingness to proactively invest to deal with it.
Definitely.
Well, let me ask you about one thing in history, because I was really, we turn to the question of can water and rivers, is the squabble over them going to cause war? Is it going to bring peace? And I was very much struck by the story of the Peace of Westphalia. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Mm-hmm.
In the New World Order book, because we are talking about an example of sort of strategic management of the water, bringing harmony and peace because of the way it was done. And so I was very struck by that as an example of the fact that water and cooperation around water can be a gateway to peace.
Yes. It's true. Especially since we know that the word rival, I mean, the technological background to that word is, of course, two people or more sharing the same rivers. So it means that the competition for water has been there for a long time. But the Westphalian Peace Agreement was an example of a different story. I mean, the need for cooperation over river, and you have the same with the Danube Commission, for example. I mean, some of these cooperative institutions in Europe has been linked to water. I mean, the Donau and the Rhine, and other rivers as well, because all parties realized that they could not be it alone. I mean, they had to cooperate in order to benefit themselves. So that is what is happening, of course, in some other countries and some other areas. The Nile, for example, cannot be developed in an optimal way without cooperation among all the countries. And some of the leaders, of course, they understand this very, very well, and they're working, trying to achieve this.
Well, before we close, tell us a little bit about your new book, because I was hoping it would be done this summer when we wanted to do this, and but it's not. But it will be soon, right?
Yes, I thought it should have been out for at least half a year. So I don't know. It's about, again, it's a kind of it's based on the journey to a number of countries all over the world, trying to reflect on similarities and differences in how people relate to this absolutely fundamental resource. I mean, if you're interested in how societies develop, of course, water is a very crucial entry point, since all countries, at all times, at all places, have had to relate to it in one way or another. So, by going then from country to country, asking different questions, did it create conflict, did it create cooperation, did it create development, how has it impacted the state history, and so on and so forth, you might get a lot of new type of answers that science that is not interested in water-society relations to the same extent, but not be able either to ask or to answer.
Have you found any any patterns of what inspires cooperation?
No. No. I have problems in finding patterns.
Yeah, it's such a complex.
That's the problem with water. I mean, it's a universal resource, but at the same time, it's never the same. Not from day to day, and not on the same day from day to day.
Right.
So the preconditions for cooperation would be so different depending upon the resource itself and the traditional cause of water control in that area, the ideas of water that have developed in that area, sharing this river. So it's so complex.
Yeah, one of the things I found most fascinating about your book was the exploration of, you know, sort of the different cultures and variables as to what worked and what didn't. And you're right, it's infinitely complex because it, you know, water impacts us in so many different ways throughout an environmental and a financial ecosystem that it's, and of course, cultures are very different. So you're right, it's very complex.
Yeah, I mean, you can just start thinking about the role of water in religion, right? In Christianity, in Islam, in Hinduism, in Buddhism. And what the problem is, of course, half the population of the world or something like that is living in international river basins. And very often you will find that these people also have different religions, and there's also different ideas about what is water, I mean, to what extent it's God given, and all that kind of thing. So you would have all kinds of, I would say, strange variables entering the political universe. So instead of looking for patterns, I would say you should look for complexities and trying to understand each and every case as good as you can.
Well, tell us, before you leave, tell us how we can stay abreast of your work, and tell us about your website and what's next.
Well, I just finished a book on the Nile, and I will finish a new documentary on the Nile this autumn. I'm about to finish it now. I traveled to all the sources of the Nile, the Blue Nile, the White Nile, in Tanzania, and the Rwindi, the Rwanda, all those places. So that's what I'm doing. And finally, I'm also trying to finish a book on the Industrial Revolution. I'm trying to analyze the Industrial Revolution in a water perspective.
And you said you're working on something related to the law as it applies to water?
Yes, that is. We are finishing that now. It's a volume in this water, a history of water series on the international.
Oh, so it's the next volume in the one I read, the history of water series. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
okay. Well, I'm very interested in the legal. Yeah, I'm very interested in the legal issues. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, thank you. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay. Well. Well, I must say that after a long period of searching for a scholar who really has encapsulated the history and the presence of our relationship with water, it was almost a miracle to find you. So I'm very, very grateful for your work and everything you're doing. And I think it is anybody who's interested in politics or investment, you know, to me, you must understand geography if you're going to be involved in either. And, you know, all the governance issues on planet Earth all come back to the most important resources, which is to me is land and water and of course, oxygen. And yet it's very difficult to find serious scholarly work on a lot of these questions that are useful for people like me, and I think you've made an extraordinary contribution, and I can't thank you enough. So, and also thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report. Tell us just are you teaching in Cambridge or?
No, I'm trying to finish a book.
Ah.
So I only
Oh well, do get back to work. We can't wait for the next one.
Thank you. Thank you for
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day, and you do it as well. Bye-bye.